Alan, who is going to chair the final hour of this today's session, which is going to be around sort of personal experiences of academics engaging with the media. So we're going to hear from Robin, from Colin, and from Marilyn Johnson via Skype, who doesn't appear to be online yet, but I shall connect with her once she is. So maybe if people could come up to the front, that might work well, because we can have the camera and the mic up at the front too.
I'll use my laptop for a bit, then attach the thing. I don't need it just yet, because I'll just read. I've got personal notes on.
Hold on, I'm not meant to be here till the second part. Oh, no.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I am meant to be here. Yeah.
Right, there's... right. Okay, so I'm Alan Munro. So this session's going to have three people. It's going to have Marilyn Johnson, who's going to come in on Skype, and she's a research fellow in the Institute of Transport Studies, Department of Civil Engineering, Monash University, and she's also a research and policy manager for the Amy Gillett Foundation, which is a wonderful charity which tries to create mutual understanding between cyclists and other road users. And it was set up after the death of Amy Gillett in Germany, is that right? Okay. So it's a really good charity. There's also Robin Lovelace, who's an environmental geographer based in Bristol.
Not true, I'm in Leeds.
You're now in Leeds, sorry. Introduce yourself. I've just got your webpage up. So you're an advocate of free and open source software for geography. Excellent. That's about right, yeah? And our third speaker is going to be Colin Pulley, who's a social geographer. And your research focus is on the social geography of Britain and continental Europe. Is that right? Excellent. So we'll do about 10 minutes each, and I'll just talk briefly a little about Peddle in Parliament and the kind of personal experiences of us engaging. Now, none of us are academics particularly. We come from a range of different backgrounds, and none of us are particularly transport academics working, being activists in terms of transport, though I've kind of moved into transport in terms of some of the things I'm interested in. But actually a lot of the kind of key people from Peddle in Parliament were kind of a motley mixture of writers, academic researchers, and various others. And I would say, as a campaign, it's proved to be I'd regard it as a very successful campaign. The Peddle in Parliament started off as an idea of getting... it was inspired by, I think, a CTC-organised flash mob to the Scottish Parliament at the time of budget, which got 250 cyclists at the doors of the Scottish Parliament. And this alerted a few people, thought, oh, that's really good. That was a big bike protest in Scotland. So a bunch of people came together at the time of when the Times Cities for Safer Cycling campaign started, and there was some talk about, well, why not do something in Scotland? So the first pedal in Parliament, the first thing that was worked really well was the name POP. It started off, a lot of people were like, oh, pedal to Parliament. And actually, one of the first things we did, I as the kind of the tame geek involved, I said, right, we've got to get a domain name. Got to get, what's it going to be? Is it pedaltoparliament.org or pedalonparliament.org? And so we put pedal on Parliament. Now, this has been beautiful because there's been popping into Parliament, pop up, all sorts of things. You can, you know, we've done about everything. So gradually support mounted, and pretty much immediately there was a Twitter account and there was a Facebook group set up. I think that was the second thing that I did, was set up the Facebook group. And gradually we get various people took turns in the POP tweets, and gradually things moved on, and we got, for example, Chris Hoy retweeting something, Graham Aubrey, so, you know, legendary sports cyclists actually, at least doing one retweet, and that really helped a lot. So by the time we met in the Meadows in April for the first pedal in Parliament, we were expecting, if we were lucky, you know, we were thought 300 people would be good, 1,000 would be amazing, and pretty much I remember turning round and the whole of the Meadows was full of bikes, and there was actually, we think, 2,500, that we said 3,000 people, but it could have been 3,000, and there was a point where the whole of George IV Bridge and the whole of the Royal Mile were just bikes everywhere, and the police were quite overwhelmed in a very nice way. They said it's one of the most successful processed events ever in the Parliament, and one of the most good-natured. So that immediately changed the game. There was a big Scottish charity, we'll call it Scotland Cycling, who, you know, metaphorically wouldn't return our phone calls, but as soon as we had that event, suddenly they were wanting a meeting. And, you know, suddenly we were on very friendly terms with Sustrans as well. And then, actually, that first year, there was an invitation to put something before the Finance Committee along with Sustrans and the cycling charity. So already at a kind of at a national level, pedal in Parliament is something. And I think it's been very successful because it's kept on with this. We are a grassroots movement. We have this, and what's been quite really useful, and I would urge every kind campaigning group to do it, is you have you have something that you can all rally around, and Pedal in Parliament had a manifesto. It had 8 points, and most importantly, it had some very, very clear objectives that we would not back down from. So we're constantly saying education infrastructure is the most important. And if people ask, well, why is infrastructure important? You say, would you let your 8-year-old on that road? And this is, suddenly you've got this wonderful, in a nutshell, you've got your position and you've got why you've got your position. So some people are much better at the specifics, and it's good to have a broad range of skills. So some people are very good in the specifics of particular policy stuff. And we've actually got other outside experts that we use for really fine-grained, nitty-gritty stuff. And people from Spokes and other groups are really useful for that. But other people are very good in the big vision. Would you let your kid cycle here? I've got an 8-year-old. I wouldn't let them on the roads. This is a tragedy. So it's been a lovely, a good mix of people. And I'd say I want to go into a particular thing that is more about the media. But I'd say that one thing that's been quite good, and it's an interesting thing about volunteer working, and I think it connects a lot to a little to the open source movement and research on the effectiveness of different types of software engineering methods. Actually, there's this wonderful thing called Brooke's Law, and Brooke's Law is something that came about from huge disasters in software engineering, particularly an IBM operating system that just swallowed manpower, person power, and swallowed time, and they threw more and more programmers at it, and it got later and later. And Frederick Brooks eventually produced this wonderful account of this and said, the problem is the more people. As you add more people, you need people to train these people up and get them on site. So suddenly things delay and delay and delay. So adding manpower to a lead software project makes it later. In a sense, when you're working with a group of people in POP, there's basically about, I'd say, 5 to 7 key people in PIL in Parliament, and they work well together. And there's thousands on the day, but you've got these 5 to 7 people that actually are very agile, that there's constantly emails coming through, that things get debated to an extent and agreed on. And this PIDL in Parliament works in a budget of, I would say, less than £1,000. And yet we're probably more successful at lobbying than a lot of big combines. You don't get onto the Finance Committee just like that. It hasn't really, you know, and by the third year of POP, PIDL in Parliament, we actually had the Transport Minister coming to speak to PIDL in Parliament. He told us a few semi-truths about all this new money that was being allowed for cycling. And pretty much immediately, once we'd analysed the money with help from outside experts, we could say, actually, this is not new money. Why did you say it was new money? Why did you stand in front of our children and say this was new money for cycling in front of these children that said to you what they wanted? Because we actually had, for the third one, we had children going, telling us what they wanted for the future for Scotland. POP has remained completely neutral in terms of Scottish independence, but constantly there is together we'll make Scotland a cycle-friendly nation. And that goes in everything we send down. So there's a constant message going on. And I think that's proved good. And we try to always be positive in the blogging message, while also sometimes individual people will, in their blogs, be much more direct and to the point. But POP will kind of draw itself back and always try a policy of engagement. Even then, we're regarded as quite, sometimes very difficult. And we had feedback that the Scottish Government found us very difficult to deal with sometimes. So it's really interesting. You think you're actually holding back, but other people are really quite upset at what you're saying. Are these cyclists ever happy? It's something, the kind of thing that comes back. But there is, like Christina said, this management of, you've got the POP Twitter account that is always kind of upbeat. It always tries to just keep the pressure on, but it's upbeat and it's constantly posting. You've got a Facebook group that constantly puts new stuff out. That's the only way to keep your group relevant on Facebook. You've got to keep updating. But the Facebook group has become a community, and groups are formed from there for individual areas. So you have feeder rides for the main POP event that happens. It's happened every year for 3 years now. being set up from all over. So there's a lot of local organisation and people just organising stuff from a really grassroots way. So it sometimes surprises us when, you know, you're thinking of getting 20 people from one area and you actually get 200. So it's a pleasant surprise to have. So I'd say for the core group, appropriate size is something that we've accidentally found that it's quite good. And I'm not saying there is a lot of everyday hassles. There's people go off and kind of maybe tweet something that they shouldn't, then other people maybe say, oh, you shouldn't have tweeted that, that was confidential, or whatever. There's all these everyday problems that we have. We're not perfect. A lot of things get fall by the wayside because there's only so much a small group can deal with. And then, oh, sorry, right. Is that my kind of time up? Okay, well, so sometimes things just fall to the side and you can't deal with them, but a small group seems to be the most effective way to do this. And if there's too much, it just falls and there's a bit of natural wastage. Anyway, that's my experience with Piddle in Parliament. And now, are we going to get Marilyn?
I'm not sure she's online there yet. Let's just carry on with Robin.
Okay. Right, Rob.
Okay. Great, yeah, thanks a lot for that. I haven't come as prepared as Alan, but I've got a few thoughts on the topic of, it says transport academics in the media, and I guess I could be defined as a transport academic, but it kind of crosses over to how we engage in the media. First thing I'd like to say, just directly following up on your example of Scotland, it seems like there are some interesting things going on. And the positive messages, it's important to have positive messages in terms of framing your values rather than just being against. It's very good to say, yeah, we're against that, but wouldn't it be beautiful if we could create this world and creating a positive story for people to latch on? And I think by the sounds of what you're saying, you've been very, very successful at that. And specifically, I wanted to ask very quickly, yes, no thing. Have you come across the advert that was put out, I think, by the Scottish Transport Department on filming a kind of maybe 8-year-old girl on a bike cycling along the
cycle space?
Yeah, and then
it's horrible.
The car's pulling out wide and saying, please respect cyclists. Is that, have you seen that?
Well, there was something else I really wanted to talk about, but I'll bitch about it later if you want.
So,
called the Nice Way Code, which was a dreadful campaign that said, it had things like in buses, don't go that way, don't go to the left, go to the right. And then someone would tweet a photograph of a bus next to a bike lane with someone going on the left, quite actually legally. And there was also someone reappropriated Nice Wee Cod and had Nice Wee Cod, as in, you know, a nice bit of cod. And there was a whole lot of pop people in their own identities also, including myself, taking the battle to their Facebook page and actually saying, no, come on, account for yourself. Why do you do this? Why are you stereotyping cyclists as this sort of person when you're not doing this with car drivers? And also, actually, a lot of the time, the criticism with a great deal of humour. And humour is one of the most effective. Humour and satire are brilliant to really show the ridiculousness of something. And that the Nice Wee Code is now offline. The robots.txt file has been deleted, so that means that Internet Archive will not hold their stuff. So they have wiped themselves from the web. All their tweets are now protected. So they have taken themselves completely offline. This is £400,000 of Scottish Government money that is now we're not able to read anymore because it was an embarrassment.
That was one hell of a yes-no answer there.
Sorry.
But thanks, very, very interesting. The point was that media is hugely important, and I've been very happy to hear people bringing up reference to the smoking issue that has been a multi-decadal, serious, embedded social problem that's driven
by a group of corporations who have vested interest in selling tobacco. And I like this analogy, I think it's appropriate. There's a lot of kind of social theorising about why people drive, the car dominant society, but I think it's also useful to say, okay, look, if you follow the money, there's a hell of a lot of money that gets spent on advertising for cars. It's being sold as a status symbol, it's going to improve your sex life, it's going to give you adventures. So the media can actually counteract that in very, very effective ways. So I wanted to bring that kind of example up as an example of state propaganda, essentially, that can counteract it. And personally, I would love to see a lot more analysis of the impact of car advertising and marketing on transport practices. And I think that's something that transport in the media thing hasn't... I haven't heard people talking about that. But if you follow the analogy with smoking, the World Health Organization has recommendations about how the media should engage with media with smoking advertising. They should ban it in certain contexts. They should certainly not allow children to be exposed to smoking adverts. Imagine watching a kid's cartoon and then suddenly like an advert for smoking targeted at kids comes online. That's not allowed. That's totally unacceptable. And maybe if we do the right research to like my hypothesis is that actually car advertising is driving car use quite a lot. If we can actually have research that shows that somehow, maybe you'll get at some point in the future regulation on car advertising. So that's an extremely exciting area that I would like to throw in there. And you know, the state the self-hating state doesn't seem to want to intervene in the market, but it can, and we should be there to support that and provide an evidence base. So I've got kind of 4 points that I just want to talk about, and they're all hopefully fairly brief. I don't know how we're doing for timing, but I'll try and run through them. My interaction with the media has been a lot less, partly out of choice as well, because my story is a story about not going to press. So I was asked to, I've been asked twice now to provide press releases for the Royal Geographical Society, the RGS. Once because I presented a paper on trying to imagine what the impacts of a peak oil scenario would be on different types of commuters. Basically, that's not solid research. It's kind of thinking about methodologies that you could use it, what data you have. And I just said, this is going to get taken out of context. I don't want to do that. Another one was the finding that Dutch commuters, on average, use more energy than British commuters. Again, a story that can get taken out of context and be used to blast the cycling agenda. I didn't want to do that, so I was like, at the last minute, take it away. That's one anecdote. I've got here a book, which is, if I'm talking to an academic audience, I think to some extent I am, I think this is a good example of how not to do it, because it's academics tend to couch things in a very theoretical way. They like abstraction, they like generalisation, but it's not at all good at engaging with the people. And we need to be careful about using plain English, otherwise you'll just get kind of shouted out as like you're just over-academicising the thing. And I'm really pleased to see this kind of interface between academics and the public happen in a kind of logical, plain-speaking way, which I think is important. I could talk more about this, but basically it's volume over quality, and it's not stated in it, it's not making a clear story. Third point is we can also make our own media, so it's great to engage with the mainstream press, but now there are tools online to make your own blog, or what I've done is write for blogs that are read by kind of subsets of the population that are particularly interested in that. So the Oil Drum is now dead, but that was a fairly big energy blog. I used to write for them, and there's nothing to stop you just saying, okay, ecologist, I'll write for you. So be diverse in how you engage. And also, I'm part of the Transport Geography Research Group, so we try and get in articles that people have written and get those out quickly. That's the third point. And the final one, in some ways the most important one, links back to Christina's talk, is really do remember your objectives when you're going into the media. And because of the addictive nature of it, it's very easy to imagine, oh, the objective is to get as many follows or retweets as possible. Go back a stage, step back. Why are you an academic? Why are you doing what you're doing? You want to change the world for the better. That's what I tell myself. So the media is only a means to an end, and when it's not doing that, you could be doing your job better in a different way. So my the point that comes out from that is, like, instead of going to the media, why not work directly with local authorities, with people that have power? And you might get 1,000 retweets, or you might influence one local authority person to make a better piece of infrastructure. So that's my final point as a cautionary one.
Okay, right. A wee housekeeping thing. Will we have Colin's talk while you try and get Marilyn?
I'm beginning to assume that Marilyn has overslept, given the fact that it's about 5:30
right.
a.m.
Okay.
So that can actually work well. Good thing. We could just carry on.
I think we should send her some flowers. Colin Pooley.
Okay, thanks, Alan. Okay, I'll try to be, again, reasonably brief. Because I don't think my experience of working with the media as an academic is anything very unusual or different from other academics who have stuck around as long as I have done. But what I have done, I think, over the years is had a number of different interactions with different media on different projects. And I'll draw on three projects in particular. One which looked at the way in which travel to work changed over the 20th century. One that looked at children's independent mobility from the 1930s through to the present and how that's changed, and then the project which done more recently, which was around walking and cycling and the issues that are relevant to why people do or do not use their feet or a bike for short trips in urban areas. If I was to sum up sort of two things which I think I would take from my experience with the media, the first is that of unpredictability, that things never quite turn out the way you expect them to, and secondly, the inability to control what is actually going on. And I think before you engage with the media, you have to accept that you are not in control of the process, and the outcome that you intended may not be the outcome that you get. But once you've taken that on board, it can be extremely profitable and extremely useful. The randomness of the process, I think, is illustrated by one of my sort of earlier interventions, and it arose, you know, in a similar way to the way that Robin didn't take off the opportunity. I was at an RGS conference, and I did give them a press release for the Travel to Work project, which was finished, so I wanted to talk about it. And I think they must have been short of news, because they picked up on it. And I got far more publicity than I'd ever expected for what was basically a historical geography project, the way in which travel to work had changed over the past 100 years. I'm not saying anything terribly revolutionary, to be perfectly honest. I gave interviews to two or three different national newspapers, rather sort of upset that the Telegraph ran by far the best story, much better than the Guardian, never mind. And the other thing which, in a sense, celebrates the randomness of the process, and I've done this a couple of times, but tended to say no recently, is that I was sort of rung up and asked to sort of go into the radio booth at about 6:30 in the morning and then be fed through sequentially to about 20 different local radio stations where you've got your 2 or 3 minutes on their breakfast programme. So you just get this disembodied voice which comes through and asks you a question which is usually very tangentially related to what it is you've done. So you have, like all good politicians, you have to be prepared to say what you want to say and ignore the question completely. And then, of course, they come back and ask you a very specific question about some transport issue in their local area, which you have no idea about, so have to try to find some way not to appear completely ignorant. So that's something which I wouldn't recommend engaging with, though, you know, I guess it's ego business boosting the first once or twice you're asked to do it, but after that you get a bit bored with it. The stories that seem to get picked up, as far as my experience is concerned, are those stories that either surprise or seem hard to believe by the journalists. And that, somewhat to our surprise, was the case with the children's mobility. This was a project which tracked changes in children's mobility, looking at four different cohorts, and came up with a conclusion that actually, rather than children today being far more restricted than they were in the past, actually the levels of children's independent mobility hasn't changed all much over the last 50 or 60 years.
Wow.
It might change much less than people expect. And basically, the reaction to that, there was a press release, the project finished, it was an ESRC project. ESRC released a press release in August, month in terms of news, and a lot of people picked up on it. And the reason they picked up on it, because they didn't believe it. Yeah, they thought we were wrong, basically. And the reactions were really interesting, but one press release generated a huge coverage, and our press office tries to monitor it, I'm not sure I got them all, but there were at least seven interviews with major newspapers, four TV appearances, at least 20 radio links, and of course then the story got syndicated and went all over the world. So again, you get this randomness coming through. Some journalists were very assiduous. Sorry, I mentioned the Manchester Evening News earlier. The Manchester Evening News I was really impressed with because journalists didn't believe me, but went out to try to replicate our research and actually did some interviews and talked to people and came back, you're right, I found the same thing. And I was really impressed that they'd actually done that. That was interesting. Crucial, I would say, to work through your university press office when you've got that degree of interest, because otherwise you can be absolutely inundated. I never give my mobile phone number to a journalist unless I'm absolutely sure I know who they are, what they can do with it. Everything comes through the press office. They know how to contact me. But I don't... Emails are fine, but not phone. Partly because my mobile phone is switched off most of the time anyway, so it'd be irrelevant. Two examples of unintended consequences, one bizarre and one slightly more troubling, I suppose. The press office picked up one example of the story which had appeared somewhere in the British press being reproduced almost identically in the Kerala Times in South India. And it was reproduced in a way where it was absolutely decontextualised. There was no way of knowing that this was a study of young people in Manchester and Glasgow or wherever it was. It could have been in Kerala, it could have been anywhere. So it's completely decontextualised and totally meaningless in that context. And the other was, it's the only time I've ever received hate mail, in that the story was obviously reproduced in an Australian newspaper, and part of it was, well, actually, some independent mobility is good for children, and it's not good to constrain them and not allow them to play out. And I got this letter done in usual sort of anonymous, typed in capitals, from Australia, tell that from the postmark, which was basically clearly very sad from someone who had lost a child in difficult circumstances, was basically accusing me of being a paedophile and all sorts of child abuser and everything else. So you put it in the bin, you can't do anything else. But there are those risks, those things happen, because where it goes and how people receive it is completely out of your control. The third project was the walking and cycling project, and in a sense, we didn't try to get a lot of publicity for the Children's Mobility Project, but got a huge amount. We tried quite hard to get a lot of publicity for the Walking and Cycling Project, and we got some, but nowhere near as much as we did for the Children's Mobility. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. The first reason was that the results, for anybody that knew anything about walking and cycling and transport, were not terribly surprising. They were things that people have said before. Secondly, particularly around cycling, that already, as was shown in your paper, quite a high level of cycling coverage in the British media. And I think it's a saturation that, do we run another cycling story which basically says that most people think that roads are too dangerous to cycle on and therefore you're required to have separated cycle routes. So I think there is this issue of saturation coverage, particularly of cycling issues. And as I said earlier, nobody seems interested in walking as a form of transport anyway. Thirdly, I think we suffered from something which, again, was almost outside our control, in that there was too much drip feed. Some media had picked up on the project relatively early on when we'd given a paper at another conference, and that conference got some media coverage. So then when we released our final report, there was a press release, and we tried to get a lot of coverage, but they felt, well, they've done it already, and they don't want to run the same story twice. And the same
were you
true
media savvy, then?
Were you too media savvy?
Oh, I think maybe we were, but then the same thing happened when a book came out and Policy Press produced a press release and sent it to loads of places, got almost no interest at all, because I think they'd seen it before. So I think if you want to try to control it, you actually have to keep it under wraps for a long time and then just, you know, release it with a big bang. But actually, if the media are at a conference, it's hard to stop them reporting on it, and that's what happened. The best coverage, in a sense, came when our research was tied to a particular event. So one of the things that it was used for was by the Welsh Assembly in the development of their active travel bill. And at an early stage of that bill, they picked up on our research, used the research to frame quite a lot of the active travel bill. I was invited to Cardiff twice to talk when they were at the consultation phase, and again to the Welsh Assembly to give evidence to the Select Committee as it was going through, you know, the process. And that got a lot of coverage by the media, newspapers, television and radio in Wales. So, but that was because it was research that was linked to a particular event, a particular set of things that was happening in Wales. And I think that's quite interesting because, you know, I mean, you mentioned Scotland, and I think actually if you're working in Wales or Scotland with a small population, easier access to government, it's actually much easier to get access to certainly the national media and coverage than it is in England, unless you're in London. You know, so if you're tucked away in Lancaster or Newcastle, it's actually much more difficult to get.
Yeah, Scotland's more like Denmark or Finland, yeah. In that way that, you know, there's a local dialogue.
Yeah, I think there is a big difference there. Final point I can make is that the arena in which the Walk in Cycling project did get a lot of interest was in the social media. And we hadn't anticipated that particularly. But particularly around cycling, there are a huge number of organisations and bloggers who are working on social media. And they picked up on the project at a relatively early stage. They've all put their report on their websites, and it generated a lot of discussion. And that discussion was actually fueled to some degree by an entirely inadvertent event, in that there was one sentence in our final report which was slightly loosely worded, and which in the form in which they saw it somewhat offended some members of the cycling community. At the time it caused a certain amount of angst, but in retrospect it was probably the best thing that could have happened, because it generated an enormous amount of interest and debate and discussion. So it got far more publicity on social media than would otherwise have been the case. And, you know, we clarified the point and it wasn't an issue. But, you know, it actually shows the way in which something is needed to draw attention to it and to separate a story from the run-of-the-mill and from everything else, you know, that's going on. So, yeah, that's my experience. You know, unpredictable and uncontrollable.
You've got time to talk about that a little bit if you want.
I think
Marilyn's not...
I don't think I've got a lot more to say. I mean, in terms of what it was, I mean, some of you will be aware that, you know, we had a series of recommendations, and one of them was that, well, we felt that both media and government paid more attention than they should to existing committed, you know, cyclists, you know, the mammals, basically, or people like them who are cycling activists, and didn't understand enough about, you know, other people who might want to cycle. And, you know, we said in a rather sort of direct way that, you know, we shouldn't listen to the cycle organisations. What we meant to say, that we shouldn't listen only to the cycle organisations. But, you know, a number of us had proved ready and didn't pick up that that was going to be a problem. They ready to say, well, we shouldn't listen to them at all, which is clearly not what we were going to say. And that's what actually sparked the controversy. But it was a controversy which generated, I mean, somebody who doesn't actually use social media a lot, far more interest than I would ever have anticipated. And it, I think it was actually good for the project.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, look, we don't think Marilyn's made it. Because it's something daft like 5 in the morning, her time. So we can open it to the floor and questions.
Just a comment, really. I mean, it, from what Colin was saying, and from my experience, it is often down to just random circumstances. I mean, I had a great survey results on transport response to bad weather. But mm-hmm. The month the results came out, we had a pretty boring month. You had months with bad snow, and bad, but the month we came, it's like, well, what's the point? There's no. So I think it does. There's always that. What else is happening in the in this sphere, and you mentioned August and that kind of thing. I think there's, you've got to have that kind of aware of what might happen, but just a kind of we'll see what happens, let's go with it, and if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen, if it does, it does, and that kind of approach, really.
So August is the place to get your results out and time your projects to end
in August. There was that classic Transport quote where the Transport person had to resign because they talked about bearing bad news.
That's right,
and
yeah, the Blair.
Yeah. I couldn't remember this morning, what was it? Was it a rail story?
I thought it was 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
It was 9/11. Hey, let's bury some bad news today.
Yeah, but no, there was a Transport story they were trying to bury. What was it? Was it a rail thing?
Maybe the report in a rail crash.
That was it. It was a rail crash.
It may have been timed when there was something else kicking off.
Yes, exactly. What the argument was. But I can't remember either what the issue was that they wanted to keep off.
But the burying bad news was a separate thing. They put out an email saying, it's
council's
expenses. Story about council's expenses.
Yeah, and it was Joe Moore. I'm just looking it up.
September 11th is the day to bury the story.
In the absence of loads of hands up, I might take the initiative and say, what do people think of my proposal of a new research agenda trying to think about the impacts of advertising on perceptions to transport? Any feedback on that? And am I right in thinking that hasn't been a lot done? Or anyone tell me about stuff that has been done?
I'm in research, but I'm exactly focusing on how advertising are encouraging more people to drive instead of cycling in some societies, and particularly third world countries are more willing to drive because it's seen as a successful stage. I bought my car, so I can leave my car in the garage. But at the same time, as I mentioned, in these countries, there's also this work together between the policy, the government, local governments, and the automobile industry. And yeah, the idea of basically promoting this. And I'm recently reading about how the instrumental use of cars are placed like in second place. and instead of that, it's more the emotional attachment to the objects or possessions. So my research
is
more
on this. I think it's a really interesting thing that I wrote something very informal in a blog a few years ago about car advertising. In fact, it's long been a thing that's driven me mad. And in fact, I got asked to do the EPSRC were doing stand-up comedy with scientists. And the big part of my routine there was about car marketing and about the imbeciles who name cars and how they're promoted. But one of the things that has always struck me is the kind of double standard. If you contrast, we talked about smoking earlier, but let's contrast this with drinking. So, for example, alcohol is actually totally harmless to society as long as it's used properly. It's only when it's abused or not used in moderation that it has any problems for society. Whereas a motor car, run off petrol, even if it's used in accordance with its instructions, is harmful to society. So there's no sort of acceptable level of it that comes with no harm. And yet, car companies are allowed, as you correctly said earlier, they're allowed to promise you essentially sex and success in return. And alcohol advertisers are banned from promising anything of that sort, and must direct you to a website where you can learn how to not use their products.
Mm. Yeah, you can't allow positive, you can't show positive emotion from drinking. You can in some countries like South Korea. Yeah. So you can actually have, drinking this whiskey, I see a phone in the sky or something.
But can you imagine also that then Ford showing an advert that it just shows some utterly mundane feature of the car, like a steering wheel, and no reaction to it, and then they have to point you to a website to tell you how to use the products. And that would be the equivalent. Yeah. And yet we don't have it. But
it's really interesting.
I think would be fascinating to, if I can add this to your hypothetical research project, would be media, especially popular culture, representations of non-driving modes. So a great example would be how, for example, cycling is portrayed in Hollywood films. And it's very often used as a shorthand way of showing a person's inadequacy. So the best example I can think of would be the opening scenes of The 40-Year-Old Virgin, where they basically showed Steve Carell on a bicycle. That has saved 5 pages of dialogue, because that one scene, that just establishes, here's a social reject. And on the one hand, it's interesting that it's acceptable to do it, and on the other hand, it's interesting because it works, and the fact it works suggests there are shared stereotypes and shared tropes about what it means to be a cyclist. So I think that would be a fascinating adjunct to this as well.
It's really, you could have a kind of reappropriation of that. There was a bit, there was a lovely film, I Heart Huckabees, which actually had, the guy was an environmental campaigner, and partly he looked pathetic, and yet he also looked dedicated. You kind of, by the end of it, you kind of, his character and Mark Wahlberg's character looked actually quite heroic. Everyone else looked insane. So it was a beautiful, it was a wonderfully daft film, a very strange film. But, I mean, these things can be reappropriated. Social media can reappropriate, but, you know, the right people can reappropriate films. And, I mean, the portrayal of homosexuality over, even now you would call it homosexuality, but from the 19, there's a whole series of films, very brave films done in the 1960s, such as one with Dirk Bogarde, I can't remember the film's name.
Victim.
Victim. Wonderfully humane film, but still, I've got this issue of this double life, you know, Twilight World of the Homosexual, to now where you have men kissing, women kissing, and it's not, oh my god, you know, it's just, it's kind of, hey, to a Nat West advert that you have twin sisters, I love my husband, I love my girlfriend, I like swimming, I don't like swimming. I just perfect, you think, actually at that point you've got something resembling a civil society. So things can be reappropriated. Sorry, I'm taking time. Other questions, please.
And may I come in on Robin's research project?
Sure.
Bandwagon.
What
particularly interests me is trying to disentangle the effect of all this communication from what seemed to me to be genuine and primal attachments to cars and car driving. I think it's possibly misguided to assume that all of this is constructed. Some of it is deep-seated and it's very natural to human beings. Car in some way appeals to us. It's no coincidence that we would do it to such an extent. So understanding what communication is doing to reinforce or build that would, to me, be a very interesting prospect.
Any ideas of how to do that? Because that's the difficult side.
Maybe there are, I don't know whether there are any cultures in which car driving is really not anything like as widely promoted, or it's promoted in a very different way.
You could actually look at variations in the type or amount of car advertising and see what that was related to.
A finding of context in which it is regulated could be.
I've used it for student projects actually, where they've gone out and they've interviewed some of the garages and then they've looked at different. It's one of those projects that it's hard to get funding and it's hard to disentangle everything. And you're kind of, and I've seen state government, like the example you mentioned, but other ones where the state tries to do kind of more sustainable transport ones, like are you doing your bit, where they get, where it just doesn't, or the Alcoholic Anonymous one, my car used in Scotland about 15 years ago, that just didn't work at all. So they're always struggling. But you could, I always like the kind of consumer response. You could always do a survey of people and try and see how they respond to different messages. And the starting point would be to look at over time how car adverts have changed. Like in the past, they were purely aimed at men. And there's been a phase where they were all looking at the open road in America, and a lot probably still are, where you're kind of driving through the Grand Canyon effectively, free road. But there has been a shift where they've gone towards some are aimed at women, clearly, or aimed at families, where you often have a child. It's quite so well to have children now in car adverts, whether it's a child saying, "Well, Daddy, you're wonderful, you've got this fancy car," and how so there has been a historical shift away, and where that's leading towards is another thing. Also, it's just the way they're advertising alternative fuel vehicles and the whole advert. I was thinking with Kylie Minogue, don't ask me why, but they have the kind of the really quiet one, and then you go shh, the hybrid or whatever. So there has been a shift away from changing the way cars have been advertised. Where that's going is another issue. But there are different languages you can kind of take.
Colin.
Well, I just wanted to come back quickly on Tom's point, because I think what I would argue as somebody who likes to look at these things from the historical perspective and to link the past mm-hmm. through to the present is that our addiction to cars is not necessarily anything per se about cars. It's what cars represent in terms of what we're trying to get out of travelling and why we travel and how we prefer to travel. And you know, so if you ask the question, you know, what are the things that people want to achieve, what they want when they travel? They want it to be relatively quick, they want it to be relatively comfortable, they want it to be relatively cheap, and they would prefer it to be relatively private, not with other people. Now, in the 18th century, if you were rich enough, you had your private carriage and you shut yourself away and you kept dry and it was as quick as it could be at that time. As you move into the 19th century, then you have a very clearly class demarcated railway systems where if you were rich enough, you could shut yourself away from other people. What the car does is to meet those aspirations as well as anything else can at the present time. But it's not in itself any different. And in a sense, I would argue that it was really only from the 1960s that the car became obviously mass transport in Britain. And that even in the 1920s and 30s, the bike was fulfilling some of those functions for men in particular, because it was quick, it was direct, it was cheap, and you didn't have to actually share a tram with other people, and by and large, men don't like public transport. So those men, when they could afford a car, moved off their bike and moved into cars. So I think it is the car, but it's not the car per se, it's what the car offers. And the only way you'll get people out of cars is either by having something else that offers the same thing or better, or by physically restricting it, making it almost impossible to use the car, either through cost or restrictions on where it can go and all the other things that you might do.
Well, I don't want to restrict the conversation. Hold on,
sorry.
Very quick response.
Bruce put up his hand.
No, I think it opens up, actually, the discussion. Because I think if we think about transport as media, rather than thinking about transport in media, reputation, transport in media, we think about the symbolic function of transport and vehicles, then we are starting to get to the sort of another question of why, what it is people like about driving so irrationally and sort of willfully in the face of all the sort of data that tells us it's a bad thing, we all know it's a bad thing. And it's to do with the symbolic value of the car in particular as a vehicle, which has to do with a sort of not just a set of sort of capacities, but the way it's a vehicle for a certain set of fantasies as well, particularly fantasies around masculinity. I think we know that's fairly well established culturally, but also even more importantly, fantasy about individuality, individual agency, control, and so on. In the face of this culture of risk, what we're tied to is this fantasy of individualism, and that's a cultural. That's at the level of our culture. It's like the DNA of the culture. It's not just to do with cars or car adverts. It's to do with the hundreds of years of history of this culture organised around the concept of the individual. So one of the challenges is disentangling the car from that cultural complex.
Tom, then Rachel.
Well, in a way, your point has made mine for me. I was just going to say in response to Colin, there's so much more than the practicalities of getting from A to B, the very strong emotional aspect. The fact that driving in a car is a ride. It's a fairground ride. So all of these things just have to be put into the mix and they're not mixed.
They do, but I would argue that in the late 18th century, the rich man with his very expensive horse loved it just as much as you love your Porsche.
Sure. Which has a Harsprit symbol.
Sorry?
Which uses a Harsprit symbol.
That's Ferrari. But
Ferrari, yeah. Sorry. I can't help feeling that this discussion is slightly old hat, though, thinking about Pete Carr and some of the discussions that are being had in transport studies. If you look at the research that TfL have done, which sadly they don't release as regularly as they might do, they've done research on young people's ambitions, and clearly some of those needs are being met by people being able to use social media on public transport. So I don't think, I think firstly there's an issue about, is there a deep-seated desire for privacy, and is that changing, which I think is up for discussion. I think also, even if there is a desire for privacy, it could be met in different spheres of life, so it wouldn't have to be met in transport. And I think one big shift we've got is like the Dilbert, the cubicle life, and the way that so many of us at work are just, you know, we're attached to our computers. We don't interact, we don't work in the kind of workplaces we used to, so potentially the need for privacy is met there. We don't want it on the way to work, possibly. So I don't know, I would problematise that a bit.
I think you could have a whole series of amazing narratives as well. You know, totally agreeing. That you could have, you know, all the erotics of the car shoved into the bike. So you could have, you know, you're going up a hill and it's like you're all sweating, get to the top, and it's your bike and no one's, you know, no one's giving you shit, you're on your bike. And you could have the whole, you know, hey, I'm in a car, I'm getting attention. Well, you could have guys and girls in bikes, checking each other out. You can have all that. You can have train travel, the erotics of train travel, because you can actually meet people, you can make friends in a train that you can't actually drive around in your car on the motorway. Compare that to stuck in the motorway, you know, waiting at a queue of the motorway, junction 25 is heavy delays or whatever. You could do all that. It's just where you point the money and where the money goes. You can have all the erotics of walking, of cycling, of, you know, unicycling, whatever. Even back feet. It can be sexy.
Raises a really interesting question, actually, thinking about it. So I think, Thomas Boyce, the car certainly fulfills a lot of these functions, and I think this issue of the emotional aspect is something we forget far too often. But I think one of the problems is it's really hard to disentangle, because as well as all those practical and emotional things, everyone alive in Britain today has also grown up in an arena whereby they've been bombarded with billions of pounds of advertising telling them that they should think that as well. And so to disentangle the effect of the advertising from those practical and emotional things, the first-hand practical and emotional things, is quite impossible. But then that raises the really interesting question, picking up on what Rachel said, why have we suddenly got a generation that have become perhaps half immune to that advertising? What's changed? And that seems like a really interesting question. Why have we got a generation that is ignoring the siren call of BMW promising them joy?
I was going to say, the interesting, I mean, on that Pete Carr research, I don't know how many of you read or seen Scott Levine's research on this. Having heard all that, I think we have to be a little cautious on that. I think the jury is still out. There is a very strong argument that says that that's an artifact. There is no evidence that young people are turning away from the car, and that the statistical trends that we're seeing actually have far more concrete causes, like, for example, the fact that the disposable income of young men has been falling since the beginning of the century.
Yeah, 1970 was the last time there was real, 1975 the last time there was real actual against inflation wage rises in the US.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm new to, I don't know. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is we should be careful about starting to believe our own propaganda on some of those issues.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of 17-year-olds insurance issues as well. I mean, I don't know that area or that age group that well, but the few that I do know, recent huge increase in car insurance at that age and the other financial pressures with students and stuff, there seems to be a lot of, whether they're short-term trends or long-term trends, I still think that people away from the car towards other modes, it's going to be more forcing through cost and other measures than the desire of alternatives.
Really, we've got to wrap up now.
So,
We're 7 o'clock.